This is Cave Scott Allen of OTCode.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Welcome to this episode of Herding Code, being recorded on March 15th in the year 2013. Today is a discussion show, just to catch up with everyone and see what they've been working on recently. And I thought maybe we could start with Scott Kuhn. What are you doing on a day-to-day basis now, in general?
Just trying not to cry.
No. most of what I've been doing is MVC with a lot of JavaScript. We got handed a legacy app, which has quickly become legendary in our group. It had a single controller that was a partial class spread among six different code files, all with different names.
Oh, my Lord.
And at last count, we had 21 dependency injections on that home controller. And that was actually one of the better parts. Just yesterday, they had a calculation in there for figuring out some points and spreads on some trades. On a trade, and it was about 360 lines, and I refactored it down to like 40, I think. It was, and that was just so that I could figure out what it was doing, and that I could start to write some tests around it, because of course there were no tests.
Well, this is what is amazing to me. Why is someone writing a class that big and a method that big, but using dependency injection?
I don't think it was a single person. I think it was a bunch of people that worked on it at different times, kind of like Bungie devs. One would bounce in and they knew dependency injections, so everything got injected everywhere. Everything was an interface. Then someone else would bounce in who was very big against or big into null checks. So they ended up overwriting all of the like toString, toTrim, all those methods, and just adding a null check before doing whatever. And they actually named all of these extension methods with the prefix toB. So it was toB trim, toB equal, toB null, toB string.
So naturally you added a or not to be extension.
Right. The tacit is dynamic, right?
I really did think about it, but I stopped myself. And, you know, so then you get someone in who they literally copied and pasted a VBA macro into the class and then just fixed it so it was C#-y.
Amazing.
Yeah. So, I mean, when people out there talk about, you should hire smarter devs, you should do this and that. And I'm like, you guys don't really work in the real world. I mean, when the guys at Microsoft sometimes they talk about, well, you know, the general person doesn't, you know, do that kind of thing. And you think, oh, well, they're just bad devs. But there's a lot more of them than there are of us. And you got to learn how to do this. I thought about doing a blog series, if only I could hire an intern or something. to just write up the refactoring, you know, that I've done on this thing, just kind of systematically. Okay, instead of getting the substring of that, you know, string you just created every time, we're just going to store that in a variable. We're going to give that variable a name. Just, you know, this, it's simple stuff.
That was when I first learned about approval tests. We did that show with Llewellyn Falco, I saw him do a presentation at San Diego Code Camp, and they refactored this real world hideous method, and it was creating graphics. And it was, you know, charts, and it was exactly the kind of code that you see like that, where someone comes in, makes something work and goes away, you know, or makes one method the way they like things and refactors enough that it kind of works and then goes away. And it reminded me of, I worked at a financial company on their intranet, and it was classic ASP, and it was 20,000 physical files on disk. And, you know, some were used and some weren't, and tons of includes and stuff. And we rewrote it into a .NET app with a CMS and stuff. There's just so much copy paste, and we're just like, how does this happen? And it's like, well, you know, contractors, someone comes in, does a little thing, they're done. It's crazy.
Yep, exactly. At the one of the JavaScript files in this thing had 7,000 lines to it, and just by getting rid of the copy and pasted code and generalizing it, I got it down to like, I think it was 1,200 lines. And, you know, you look at that and you're like, oh, well, yeah, there's a lot less code to maintain there. all right. They had included like every boilerplate JavaScript thing that MVC includes. They just included in the project whether or not they were using it. So I actually wrote a little app that went through and said, okay, look through all the views and find out, you know, what's the actual list of names of JavaScript files that are linked. Everything else we're going to delete from the project. On the plus side, we've adopted Octopus Deploy here where I work. And so we've been slowly trying to move older programs onto this, older projects. But since this one is new and hasn't been deployed to production, we got kind of in on the ground floor. So we've started making it octopusable, which is a new word that I'm going to trademark and sell buttons for.
Awesome.
And that has been kind of a dream. It's a very easy system to work with. And since it provides pre, post, and during PowerShell script running, yeah, you can, you know, whatever it doesn't cover, you can just do. So that's kind of my work.
Yeah, good.
I just want to say it's stories like these that give me hope that no matter how bad things get, I'll probably always be able to find a job somewhere because there is so much of this crap code out there.
You know, but my original theory is that every company, no matter how big or small, Fortune 500, Fortune nothing, there is a rinky-dink Excel spreadsheet or Access database that the company is actually vitally dependent on and actually runs things. And you will always have a job upsizing that to SQL Server and an actual app. And that's exactly what this project was. Someone had cobbled together something in VBA macros and Excel that did all this stuff, and they got, you know, multiple billions of dollars going through this spreadsheet. And then someone realized it, and they said, oh, this should be a web app. We should probably have this, you know, in source control or something too. And there will always be a job for upsizing that rinky-dink Access database.
You know, it's funny too. There's like, I've seen things that try and automate that a little bit, and you can kind of like, there was something I think in Visual Studio 2012 that would find code clones, and it would like analyze like not just, you know, string matches, but actually like, you know, it would find the same
like patterns and stuff. Yeah.
But there's just so much where you've got to sit down and like archaeology, you know, like detective work and figure out what was this person trying to do, you know, not what did they do, but or what code did they copy and paste in, but what were they actually trying to do?
Like 10 years ago, I used to do a little presentation called Forensic Development. We kind of coined it because that's exactly what it was doing. It was someone hands you a pile of code and you got to figure out what it does and how to make it do this new thing that they want it to do. And that was the first 6 months on this project was just, hey, can we actually compile this thing and have it stand up on a web server and use it? And then find out if it actually does what they need. And turns out that, of course not. It didn't it didn't do anything that they needed correctly. So it's been kind of fun and maddening. I mean, it's kind of fun to write the JavaScript and to do this refactoring stuff if, you know, you're the kind of person that thinks that's fun. But at the same time, you know, if I got put onto a different project, I'd be okay. In fact, I'd probably do a little jig on top of my chair.
So what's Kevin been doing?
So I have been working on my own website, which people may have seen when I tweeted about it. What was that, last week, a couple weeks ago? It's been my own little project. It's called greaterthanparts.com. And it's sort of a shopping site to help people who... Well, the seed for the idea came out of the frustration I was feeling when I was trying to build a computer. This was actually a couple of years ago. And, you know, you have to find all these parts and pull together all these parts. And, you know, when you're building computers, you like, you know, are mixing and matching parts into different configurations. And I was trying to keep track of it all on spreadsheets. And you have different stores. You know, some parts you get from Newegg, some you get from Amazon. And I just found the whole process really painful and just a pain to manage on spreadsheets. So that was sort of the seed for the idea, which I had a couple of years ago. And then recently I have been building it. So I just did sort of it was supposed to be sort of a soft launch where I tweeted out to get a few people's opinions. And it got retweeted by a couple of friends of the show, Scott Hanselman and Jeff Atwood. And of course, they have like massive followers. So I got a few more people looking at the site than I originally anticipated, but it's been cool. You know, we got a little bit of feedback, and I'm looking to get more if people want to go try it. I mean, it's just what's in the site right now is just sort of the core idea of the site. More stuff is going in, but that's what I've been working on.
And that's with, I think you'd said before, but you've got Backbone Marionette, Stickit.
Mm-hmm.
And then are you, what database are you using? Is it like Mongo or?
It's Mongo, yeah. It's a full JavaScript stack. So it's Node, it's Mongo for the database, you know, like you said, Backbone, Marionette, JavaScript end to end. Scott, I know you're jealous.
Sigh.
Where do you host?
Oh, it's hosted on Heroku.
Yeah.
The database is hosted on MongoLab.
Mm.
It's a super nice sort of hosting experience for us. You know, it's a small site. I don't have very much traffic so far. But that has been great so far.
What would you say is the number one thing that you've learned while you were building this?
That's a good question. Well, one thing I learned, a hard lesson the very first day it launched, was people really don't like to sign up for sites to try them. Mm. And, you know, this is not earth-shattering news. Like, I had always kind of planned to put in a guest login kind of mode. But it was like loud and clear. The biggest feedback I got was I don't want to have to, you know, create an account. And the site doesn't have username and password login. It only has social login because I don't want to be managing usernames and passwords. And so, people are a little paranoid about that, even though really the only thing that I use for use those social logins for is to get their email address. Basically, I don't like access their friends or anything like that. But people are still, especially I think developers, who are probably a lot of the people who are trying the site, are a little bit persnickety about that. So I launched the site and then I got all this feedback. And so I scrambled and put in the sort of a guest login by that afternoon, the launch. And a lot of people use it. I mean, half the users that have tried the site are guest users.
Cool.
So, it's guest users as in like, no, it's completely anonymous, like not a username, yes, password, right?
Right. So, yes. Okay. But it's so it uses a cookies that's tied to their machine. So they can, as long as they're on the same machine, they can keep, you know, accessing their anything that they create.
I generally feel like, you know, I am wary about, you know, creating an account on a new site that makes me type in a password, because, you know, odds are good that eventually one of those small sites will lose that password. And then I have to worry about, well, did I use this password anywhere else? And if not, you know, it's just a pain. But I mean, if I can log in with some sort of, you know, OAuth thing, then I usually don't care as much. As long as, and now lately they'll say what permissions they're requesting, you know, if they're just sticking the email address.
So that was my original thinking too, was, well, you know, if it's super easy and people don't have to create a new account and they don't have to worry about me getting hacked and, like, you know, exposing their information, then I would think that would be better. But apparently that wasn't enough.
Interesting.
So the guest login thing seems to work pretty well. It's pretty painless. And it's not a, people can put data in and not lose it. It's not just like, you know, here's a little playground that it's going to get dumped, you know, the next day. The other things I learned from the technical perspective was, and I feel like I'm still learning this, like there's definitely the Node way of doing things. And I think when I started this project, I sort of had a more Railsy mindset, even though I haven't done a lot of Rails. I played around with it enough to kind of, you know, sort of have, and, you know, it's MVC, it uses the same sort of ways of thinking. And so there's definitely doing things the Node-y way is definitely been a learning process, and one that I feel like I'm still developing on. In terms of, you know, how do you create modules and, you know, sort of how do you structure code and that sort of thing.
Well, yeah. I mean, anything else that you want to share about Greater Than Parts or?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I really just want to get people's feedback. And I mean, I have a lot of ideas of things that I can add to the site, but I'd love to hear what other people would like to see.
All right. So greaterthanparts.com.
Yep. www.greaterthanparts.com. Check it out if you, you know, if it's, the original idea was for computers, but, you know, if you're building a bike, we've used it, we sort of dog food the site. We used it to do our Christmas shopping, you know, because when you have kids and family, there's lots of, you know, it's becomes a fairly complex project, but in and of itself, we're using
it. Can I build a woman with it?
I don't have that project type yet, but you can, well.
You can make your own project.
Yes, you can create your own project. So we have like some canned projects, like, you know, computers and home theater, and it gives you all, sort of pre-populates all these categories of parts that you need in order to build that out. But then you can just create what's called the general project, and then, you know, put in your own categories. Scott, arms, legs, face.
Face.
It's the weird science project.
Oh. And you can, I like, also the design. It's not the gigantic super font or the hard to read teeny font. It's comfortable.
Okay, that's good to hear. My wife is a web designer and did the design, so I can't take any credit for that.
I'm curious, design-wise, if you got a lot of time, like when I see people design feedback specifically, people are very like certain about their opinion, and they often contradict each other completely. I'm curious if you saw if you got like some clear themes, or if you know what I mean, if people were just kind of all over the place.
People were all over the place. Some of the feedback was just good and obvious. Like it was inconsistent font usage in one place and, little stuff like that. A lot of it was just like, I don't like this gradient. Like, well, okay. But I did actually, it was sort of shocked. I got, one guy tweeted at me, the UI looks like it could use a little bit of work. So I tweeted back, oh, you got anything in specific? And so he tweeted me a link to a PDF, which is like 3 pages of, detailed design feedback, some of which, was good, some of which was just sort of, design opinion, aesthetic opinion. But I was very impressed. So
There's the guy who's going to want to build a woman on the site.
There you go. But yeah, that's awesome that somebody... time to do that.
Scott, you seem very focused on this this project. I hope that works for you.
I don't know. I think I really just want a nanny. So I just assume the girls would be more comfortable with a woman. Someone to watch the kids so that we can go out.
Oh, Lordy. Mr. Galloway, what have you been doing lately?
I've been kind of jumping back and forth between a lot of different things. A few weeks ago, there's MVP Summit, and I did the day after MVP Summit, we did this full day Jumpstart video thing, Scott Hanselman and Damian Edwards and I did. So that was cool, and I kind of organized all the content for that. So that was interesting. And Scott Kuhn helped. Yes, he answered questions, so that was cool. It's interesting to me how speaking for 1 hour, most people can kind of make things up for an hour. But when it goes up to 2 or 3 or 4 or more hours, it gets a lot harder. And there was that kind of release stuff. And then, lately I've been organizing these web camps. We've got these, web camps coming up, 11 different cities. I'm doing 4 of them. I'm doing Denmark and, San Francisco and, San Diego and Istanbul. Istanbul, Mini. And I'm getting very used to the not Constantinople joke, which is a good joke, but I feel sorry for the people that live in Istanbul. They probably hear that quite a bit. And then a bunch of just random things, like input on upcoming ASP.NET and WebStack release things and tech review to magazine article and just kind of random things that are happening. And then nights and weekends, I've been working on a programming Windows 8 with XAML and C# book, which is interesting. There's some things I really like about it and some things that are kind of different. So that's been kind of neat just to keep up with that other world of things. And that's about it.
Did you guys see the... I linked to it yesterday or day before that. This guy wrote about why it was hard to write Windows 8 apps, and he pointed out specific API limitation, not just XAML. He was like serious about it. He was like, I can't do this if I want to preview Office documents. There's no way to do it, and there was storing compressed data. Like there was no way to do password protected zip files or anything in the Windows 8 API. He had a I'll have to find it here and put it in the show notes, but
yeah, I'm interested in the list.
He had some very pointed opinion, and he had actual examples. It wasn't just rant.
Yeah, I mean, there definitely is kind of a subset, or it's an app model. So there's things you can do and things you can't. I'm sure some things over time, like looking at how things change with Silverlight or Windows Forms or any of those, things grow and change over time. But I think some things that I hear people want to build desktop apps. For it's not the same thing. Like there's a limit of you're not going to be able to browse around the C drive, and you have to expect it may be running on an ARM device or whatever.
It seems like one of the big issues, one of the big risks with Windows 8 is that when the .NET framework was decoupled from the OS, they could rev that stuff and sort of fill in the gaps. It's a much bigger deal to rev the base OS, even though I think Microsoft has made noise about how they're going to do yearly releases. people generally don't absorb yearly releases of Windows, or at least there's been no history of that. So it's going to be a challenge, I think.
Yeah, it's, you know, I mean, I've had a Surface for a few weeks now, and I have, you know, gotten firmware updates and stuff. So I mean, and also apps can update. So I think that, you know, there's potential for that. I really haven't run into, I mean, I can see how, you know, for some scenarios you really would want to do something and, you know, could get blocked by it. But for most things, if you're building something that you would consider an app, I haven't run into huge blockers. So I don't know.
I don't know if these are necessarily huge blockers. I just linked the article there, but because I haven't tried to build these. But for the things that he was trying to do specifically,
yeah,
there were some problems. Like, he wanted to display like a help file. And then the web view, for some reason, didn't support some of the things that, you know, you would normally think would be in a web, like a web help file.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that is one interesting thing, is the difference in capabilities between the C# XAML side and the JavaScript HTML side. And, you know, there are some things, like I saw somebody looking for, they were trying to do geolocation or something in, I forget exactly what it was, but it was something you couldn't do in C# XAML. And then somebody said, well, you can do it in the HTML JavaScript side because it's supported by IE, which is, you know, it's basically that, you know, rendering engine and everything. And so one thing that I've thought that's interesting is I hear people writing their business logic in C#, and then you compile that to a WinMD, which is like an assembly, and then creating an HTML JavaScript app and referencing the C# stuff. So basically, it's kind of almost like the Xamarin approach. You know, you're writing your logic in C#, and then you're writing using, you know, the HTML JavaScript stack. And what I find kind of appealing about that is then you can, if you like the way HTML and CSS work, then, you know, you can take advantage of that, which I kind of do, you know. So then you can get the, like, CSS styling, and you can do all the kind of semantic HTML markup and HTML5 stuff. And so, I mean, I'm enjoying the C# XAML approach to it, but I can see places where I would want to do that. So specifically, the reason I'm thinking about that is, you know, you're mentioning this guy's wanting to display HTML help file. And I would think, well, maybe in that case, instead of writing a C# app and using a web view to actually just do the HTML JavaScript, and it might have been easier.
Well, maybe it sounded more like he was wanting to, like it was an existing product that had a help file, and they were writing the app in WinRT or whatever, and they didn't want to have to rewrite the whole app in HTML. Anyway,
yeah,
I don't know. Read the article, man, when you're writing your book.
You know, I can't read the article now because it's a wall of text, and there's no pictures, and there's no bolded words.
What? There's no... Oh, my gosh.
How can I mean, seriously, what's the web for?
Well, you know, get Hanselman and Atwood to add some pictures to it for you.
You know, I used to use a site, tldr.it, and there's some others out there that will try and auto-summarize text for you. And most of the time, they're just comical, but then, you know, when I get like a huge wall of text, I at least give it a shot. I found that it does not work at all for reorg emails, unfortunately.
No one can figure those out.
You know, one point, I was reading through this post, and one good point I think he makes actually at the very beginning is about these Microsoft campaigns to just generate apps. Like, looks like right now if you enter an app and get it into the store, you can get a $100 Visa card, and you can do that up to 20 times to get $2,000. Every campaign they've had so far just seems to emphasize quantity over quality.
I definitely, I mean, at the risk of getting myself in trouble, but I definitely agree. I understand that there's pressure because all the journalists only write about that. That's how many apps are in the store, how many apps are in the store. And, you know, that's like, it's all about numbers. As far as any tech article you read, and especially any that's in a businessy, you know, like less tech and more businessy, all it is numbers. So I can understand why that may be motivating that, but I really think good quality apps is where it's at. Like when you pick something up, everybody I talk to, or, you know, that picks up, you know, I've got the Surface now, and people that pick it up are like, well, can I do this or that, you know? and kids are a great example. Like, and my oldest kid's 12, she's old enough where I can just say, like, here, check it out. And she knows how to get to the store and get stuff. And she finds the cool apps before I do, you know. It's fun to see, you know, there's some places where it really, there are some cool things, and others where it's like, I would like more of different things. But I totally agree. It's what can you do with it, not how many are there. And actually, too many apps is not good. You know, like a bunch of low quality apps just means it's harder to find a good app. I one thing that's Aaron Stannard, I interviewed him myself for a show back at Build, and he had pointed out to me that the Windows App Store model has a try and buy system. So any paid app, you can set it up so that it can be, you know, you can try it first, which skews the numbers because for Android and I think for iPhone, it's basically you have two apps and you have the free trial version of the app. And then if people like it, then you link them over to the store and they buy the app, you know, they buy the paid one. So out of the box, you've got twice as many. And it's nice on the Windows, you know, like Windows model to just try something. And then if you like it, you buy it and you don't have to go and delete the old trial app and jump through those hoops. But again, it skews the numbers.
Yep. This is the problem with metrics.
Yeah. I have to say, I was supposed to get, they made this big announcement, you know, last, I don't know what it was, October, about how every Microsoft employee would get a Surface. And I finally just got one due to being a remote employee and all this stuff. But I like it. I mean, it's nice for the basic kind of all the apps that I would use on a tablet. And then it also has, I don't know necessarily, I mean, I've got other laptops, but I could see for like a kid that's writing reports in Word and needs to submit the report in Word or like basic kind of stuff like that. It's got all the Office stuff and it's got the apps. I can see at least the idea with it now. It makes more sense to me. Yeah.
Right. All right. Moving on. Oh, so is anyone sad to see Google Reader go?
Yes. Very.
Yeah. So speaking of metrics, I guess they came out and said that usage has declined. We're just not going to support the service anymore. It's going to close effective July 1st. And then it turns out, I think, that the people that do use Reader are very passionate about it. So there's been a big backlash and protests and petitions and videos. I mean, personally, I think it's very sad. I used Reader on like 3 different devices, and it's a great way to consume information.
I was kind of sad, but then I thought about, you know, how many times I have to remind myself to go check it instead of, you know, it used to be something that was just open. You flip back to it all the time, but now I have to remind myself to go check it. I think mainly because I get the information different ways, like through Reddit or Hacker News or through Twitter links, Facebook, stuff like that. So instead of having to subscribe to, you know, 50 different blogs, I just, you know, wait for people to tweet the good stuff or to link it on Reddit, and then I check it out and see if I like it.
So you're part of the problem.
I guess I am. I also know that there's like 50 other things out there that consume RSS, so I'm not too worried about it. I had already moved a lot of subscriptions into, I use an app for Nook and for iOS called Pulse, and that lets you just enter in a feed, and it displays it in a nice little slippery, slidey, touchy kind of way.
Yeah, I have to say I'm in that boat. I used to, at one point I subscribed to like 1600 RSS feeds and I really actually read them, and that was well before Twitter. And then I've kind of moved to the point where I don't really subscribe. I mean, I have a Google Reader account I haven't checked for months. I do use it kind of as a back end in a podcast app that keeps track of what I've listened to and stuff. But I kind of get my information off of Twitter and Hacker News. The comments are a waste. The comments are basically YouTube quality, but people fronting that they've been programming, you know, in Lisp for 90 years. I don't think Hacker News is great for discussion, but it's good for, you know, finding out good stuff. But people say a lot of the, you know, for grazers like us, we're still, the people we see tweeting the links are getting them off of Google Reader. So, you know, it's a whole ecosystem. And I'm not sure about that. I do use, and like, for instance, Hacker News, I don't know how things get there, you know, but a lot of it is just people vote things up or down. And then on Twitter, I use this site called the Cadmus, CADMUS, some Greek god or something. But and it does this kind of cool filtering thing where it looks at my, you know, how many people I follow on Twitter. It looks at their tweets and it analyzes how many of their tweets get retweeted or how many conversations happen or things like that. And it really intelligently surfaces what is most interesting to me. So I follow, I don't know, several hundred people or more. No, I follow over 1,000 people. And But it figures out, so I can go through at the end of the day and take a look at that and say, oh, okay, these people had this long conversation. That actually was worthwhile, and I missed it because I was actually working. But so I think that, you know, like our reading RSS feeds, I think it's still very important. I mean, obviously people subscribe to this podcast using RSS, and I think RSS as a platform is great. But I personally think that, you know, things are changing so that it's important to read things manually. But I think that we are getting to, like, computers can bubble stuff up for us.
Yeah, interesting. I guess, I mean, I was one of those people that had just kind of stuck with Reader. And I'm on Twitter, but I don't watch it every minute of the day. And I guess I'll have to find a new workflow for finding interesting things. I guess what bothers me is that, you know, there's some blogs out there, some things that I'm subscribed to in Reader that will never be make the top article on something like Hacker News, but it might be someone that I'm interested in or a specific niche that I'm interested in. So I'll have to find something to replace that. And I tried out Feedly yesterday, and it seemed to do a reasonable job of following specific RSS feeds, so hopefully they'll stick around.
You know, I used to use it more, and I use it for offline reading, and it was, I forget what it was. It was Google something, and it was a browser plugin that did local storage and some other stuff. Do you remember, anyone remember what that was called? And then they discontinued it. And they said that they were doing that, you know, pending moving stuff to HTML5 local storage, and they kind of did half-heartedly.
Right. It was like a version of Reader that was using WebSQL or SQLite or whatever on the client, right?
Yeah. Yeah, but it was actually, I forget what their thing was called. This was a few years ago, but it was like an actual plugin thing. But yeah, anyhow, that was useful to me. Long ago I used, what was it? The one Daros Obasanjo did, it was some RSS
Bandit.
RSS Bandit. And then there was something, then I actually, as a younger programmer, thought that I was going to write my own local RSS reader that was going to, you know, do this collective intelligence thing and figure out, like, surface the most important posts. And I wrote all this code, and then I used SQLite, and I realized that SQLite didn't work very well multi-threaded. And so then I got into Firebird, and then I also, that was what led me to reading about in Hibernate, because I was moving database engines, and then that led me to reading Allende's blog and stuff. So it's funny how, like, and then I gave up on that idea. It was way too hard.
It was pretty much all downhill from there, wasn't it?
Exactly. And here we are talking about Twitter.
Well, I think one of the bummers about discontinuing Google Reader is that Google Reader has become the de facto back end for a lot of native reader clients, you know, iOS clients, whatever. They all use the Google back end as, like, their sync engine. So now those people all have to, you know, come up with a new way of doing things. I remember back in the old days of RSS where, like, you know, if you had your RSS client on multiple machines, then you had to, like, keep track of which articles you've already read, and all the Google RSS stuff in the back end made all that go away. So now people are going to have to solve that problem again.
Well, exactly. And that's the bigger deal, as you're saying. And that's, people are talking about, well, why doesn't Google just open source this? And that's not really the problem. I mean, the source code is important, but we've had, like, Google hosting this service for a long time. Dig has been saying that they're going to create a clone that's got API compatibility. So that's maybe interesting. I saw that they were doing that, and then John Sheehan, you know, tweeted, don't write compatible APIs, write the API that you will love or that your customers will love or something. But I mean, that whole idea of just filling in, like you're saying, Kevin, that sync engine, that's a huge win for if they can do that, you know, and fill that gap.
Yeah. I mean, some people, like Marco Erman, blogged that he thought, you know, that this was going to lead to a renaissance, that because Google sort of came in and stomped out all competition with their free RSS reader, that there's been no innovation in this space, and that, you know, now that they're going to be gone, maybe there will be. I guess only time will tell on that front. I think there has been some nice stuff on the client end, and I think that's partly because they didn't have to worry about this back end sync stuff, so they were able to focus on creating nice client experiences. So I don't know, we'll see if he's right. I'm a bit skeptical on that one, but
I want to know what Richard Stallman thinks of it all.
Well, you know, it is nice that this is one of those places where it is good that we were not using just Google's news app or whatever, like it was built on RSS. And, you know, there's times where it's like, oh, yeah, we are actually, we do have some nice open formats. You know, I read this article recently and it was a spoof or, you know, like whatever, a news article. And it was saying from 1999, you know, the World Wide Web Corporation announces they're being bought by AOL. And, you know, it's written as a press release and it talks about how this is going to be better for users because there aren't going to be any more dead links. And, you know, AOL will be curating things and stuff. And I mean, it is nice that some of these things and it almost feels kind of lucky that it happened. I mean, I know people worked really hard for it, but like that HTML and JavaScript and RSS and, you know, a lot of file formats and things actually are open and not going to go away just because a company shuts off a service.
Yes.
Am I the only one that's had 3 cups of espresso today?
Yes. You should have emceed. Well, how about we do this? How about we do one more topic and then maybe a lightning round and wrap it up because I think we're close to an hour.
Sounds good.
All right. So Glenn Block recently tweeted about his new little project ScriptCS, which has kind of taken off. And for people that haven't seen it yet, you can basically, once you install ScriptCS or have this on your system, you can create a .csx file, type in some C# code, maybe run NuGet a few times from the command line to bring in some packages for assemblies that you might need for something like the web API, and then run ScriptCS and you have a programming that is executing. So behind the scenes, it's using Roslyn to basically parse that C# code like a script and get things running. It's one of the samples they have on the ScriptCS GitHub repository is creating a web API with just a little bit of C# code and some NuGet packages, and there's no Visual Studio, there's no CS proj file. It's very light and quick. What do you guys think of that?
I think it's an interesting idea. At first, I didn't quite get what it was. I thought it was a basic command line compiler kind of thing that was able to detect NuGet packages and package them up. But when I saw that it was kind of a script implementation, so you could just write .csx files and execute them as scripts, I thought, oh, that's kind of interesting. We kind of knew that was going to happen with Roslyn anyway, but it's nice to see it, you know, packaged up in a nice little bundle for you to use. I had asked him about it outputting assemblies, because one of the projects that I've been working on kind of on and off has been it's a project starter kind of program. Do you guys remember the name of that one that basically you just run it and it would give you a basic directory layout? Something tree, I think.
Yeah, there have been a few of them.
Yeah. So anyway, my idea was...
two websites?
Oh, Lord have mercy.
Oh, sorry.
No.
Didn't say that out loud. Never mind.
So anyway, mine is just another one of those, but mine's based on a JSON configuration file. So you can add in new directories to the JSON configuration file, and then I also am going to add in a section where you can specify NuGet packages to automatically include in the packages directory. And then basically it's just based off of a MS build project file that just looks in the source directory and says, all right, get all that stuff. The idea is that you edit the MS build file by hand. And I thought, well, if this Roslyn, you know, ScriptCS could automatically detect the NuGet packages and round up all the .csx files, and maybe I could tell it to round up all the NuGet packages, add them as references, round up all the .cs files and output an assembly or an exe. That would be kind of the missing link for this project starter thing, where it'd be a complete command line driven method for devving and revving .NET apps. The idea being that if you start with a command line project, then you're automatically set up for CI.
Yeah, that's interesting. And like, getting away, as you've said, getting away from project files has been, you know, and project file-based builds has been something you've been interested in for a while, too. Yeah, it's kind of like, they have a separate repo, scriptcs-samples, with a bunch of different things, and people have already done Nancy, RavenDB, Service Stack, Live Reload, WPF, Web API Host. I mean, quite a lot of different things. So, and they've got it running Mono and OS X. One person had an interesting comment on it, that it's kind of what a lot of us hoped that PowerShell would have been. Like, you know, you can do a lot of stuff with PowerShell, but the syntax, I will never learn the syntax. Like, I've relearned, it's like regular expressions, like doing anything complex with regular expressions. Every time I have to go look at a bunch of stuff and relearn it, because the syntax just makes no sense to me. You know what I mean? So, like, and I've written a lot of complex PowerShell, like with NuGet stuff, and it's just like, I cannot understand it. It's a foreign language I'll never learn. And so Script.cs sounds really neat to me. And you know, like people have said, well, what if NuGet, instead of using PowerShell, used C#? It would be portable. You know, like that's a problem that the Mono folks have with NuGet packages, is that some of them rely on PowerShell, which isn't as portable because it's Windows-centric and stuff. So if it was C# code, that could be pretty neat.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because where Glenn's, a lot of the ideas for this project, you know, came from all of Glenn's work in the Node community. And he saw some of the really awesome stuff that Node has and Node does, and sort of wanted to bring that back to the .NET world. So as a Node guy now, I got a chuckle out of that. And I have to say, you know, doing my Node dev stuff, I use Vim instead of an IDE. And it's just something so nice about having this immediately snappy, like just a non-laggy development experience. Like no matter how good Visual Studio gets and no matter how fast computers get, those IDEs just have this I don't know, this overhead to them that is just
painful. You're at the command line or whatever, you type Vim or gvim and it's there, and you can even tell it, you can even set it up to open up the last files you had open. You can install stuff like NerdTree and what's the other one, Command T or something like that, to go browsing your file system to find out what you want. Got all the window tab management. The window and tab management is way, way better than Visual Studio. And it's just, you know, there's a big learning curve in terms of the syntax and everything. You're learning how to get around the windows. But once you get started, I mean, you know, it goes back to that calculator test kata string calculator that Gary Bernhard did in Vim, where he's got test in one window, implementation in the other, and a bar across the bottom that tells him when the test passes or fails. And that kind of stuff is easy to set up in Vim. I'll do that a couple of times. I'll have a console window running that runs Giles in the background, which is an auto tester for C# when I'm working on my little project starter thing. And I just have, you know, the tests in one window in tabs and the source in another window, and I've got Giles down there telling me when stuff breaks.
Yeah, that just, the heavy duty IDE experience just becomes death by a thousand cuts after a while. Like, it's just, you know, these little delays, little hitches. It's just, once you separate yourself from that, it's kind of hard. I find it hard to go back.
Visual Studio is doing something in the background. Please wait. Wait. Don't you have more than one thread?
Yeah, it's funny. I don't get that as much, but maybe it's because, like, I'm using the newer releases of Visual Studio and I'm working on smaller projects where it's not having to compile a huge amount of stuff. But I don't get that kind of like waiting for first stuff. I mean, yeah.
Try it sometime. Like, try doing some.
Yeah, I have.
CS stuff.
I don't,
John,
know.
You're not following the Microsoft employee script. You're supposed to say that it's a third party add-in that is causing all the troubles. And if we just wouldn't use those, it'd be better. Yeah.
Well,
ReSharper, CodeRush, or, you know, NuGet Package Installer Manager. Yeah, that's the script for softies.
Well, I'm not saying, but I am saying, because a lot of the time when I hear people complain and I ask, they're always using some heavy add-in.
Oh yeah, and right? I'm sure that these add-ins are causing some overhead. But then you think, okay, so why do we need the add-ins in the first place?
Yeah.
Oh, because the IDE doesn't support all that stuff we want to do.
But then, does Vim support all that stuff you want to do?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think a lot of the stuff people are using ReSharper for is not in Vim either. But it's like, well, you know, so it's like,
it is, but it's not by default. Just like ReSharper isn't in Visual Studio by default. You have to go find the plugins. You have to go find the scripts and include them.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, I guess, you know, it's good. There's a lot of different options.
I do wonder.
Yeah.
Like,
right tool for the right job. That's the end of the Microsoft script there.
And I'd be interested to see how difficult it is to program .NET without the help that the IDE gives you. I mean, I think part of, you know, the way the framework is designed and the languages are designed is sort of in concert with the IDE. And when you have one and not the other, like, how much friction do you add? You know, the base class library is so huge. Like, how much can you do without IntelliSense?
I do agree. I think it'd be, I mean, I think then that's a reason why people use them both together, you know?
Yeah.
I do think, I mean, I've been pretty impressed with what they've been doing lately with the web tooling stuff, like all the, you know, live compiling of CoffeeScript and less, and, you know, like all, and the, oh, the HTML.
That's all Web Essentials, isn't it?
Well, a lot of it was Web Essentials, and then some of it got rolled into the latest release they did in February.
Oh yeah.
So they're using Web Essentials as kind of like the quick prototype, and then, you know, a couple of times a year or whatever, that gets rolled up into the an official release. So, but that's one place where I had been like always like Notepad plus for all the HTML editing, and then Visual Studio for the C# stuff. And I've more often, or I haven't been using Notepad as much because it's like, well, I can actually get some use out of, you know, the web tools because they're like, you know, applying some intelligence to, you know, what are the valid attributes for a video element or whatever.
All right, I think it's time for a lightning round. Who's excited?
Well, I was. I'm not that excited anymore.
Oh, we can cancel it.
The espressos have worn off, or?
Oh, come on, a 3-question lightning round. It's like question number one, maybe no one cares, but Samsung released the S4 this week. Is anyone excited about that? Anyone at all?
I'm not.
No. I mean, is the whole new smartphone release thing just completely lost its effect now?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, especially in the Android world where that happens every, you know, 3 weeks.
Yeah, this is what I suspected.
Although there are a couple of interesting things I'd be curious to try and see how they work. Like there's some sort of thing where they track whether you're looking at the phone and then, you know, like scroll and stop scrolling if you look away from the phone.
Oh, that's not creepy at all.
I know. It is a little weird, but it'd be interesting to see if that works or if that's just like gimmicky stuff.
Well, anyway, here's another question. I'll go around to each of you. If you had to teach someone JavaScript, like a very beginning person, maybe even a kid, and you wanted to have the simplest possible setup, what would you use, Scott Kuhn?
Chrome or Firefox with Firebug or the Chrome DevTools. One of those, yep. You know, either Chrome or Firefox. It's the easiest way just to start. And you can always load in jQuery, you know, from a CDN if you want to, inject it in. You show them how to get around. And the fun parts are when you go and you like, you go to a website they're familiar with, and then you look at the JavaScript and you and say, okay, so let's see, how will we change that text or how will we change that color? And, But yeah, pretty much just, you know, Firebug or the Chrome DevTools in Chrome. And just start from there and just have them modify an HTML page on the fly.
Kevin?
Well, this is to learn the JavaScript, the language, or to learn how to interact with the browser, or like what's the end here?
Well, I was thinking more of learning, maybe even learning to program JavaScript. But Scott had a pretty interesting take on that too, because a lot of people can identify with web pages and being able to see JavaScript running there and maybe change something is interesting too. But I don't know, what were your thoughts?
It was just the first REPL for JavaScript that I could think of.
Right. Yeah. Right. Well, I mean, there's a couple things I would consider. If I wanted to do browser kind of stuff, I might, instead of people having to, you know, work directly in the dev tools, have like a live reload kind of setup where you have a browser on one side and an editor and then a live reload setup. So you can, you know, make your changes and immediately see those changes, but without necessarily typing into the browser editor, which is not necessarily the best editor.
Mm-hmm, right.
But if it was just like learn raw JavaScript as a programming language, then, you know, Node is actually pretty good for that. Node has a nice REPL and, you know, you can create scripts and, you know, write for loops and console log your output and all that kind of stuff.
Right,
so if you're
going
to do like, you know, JavaScript cone kind of development, it's super lightweight. It's easy to install. It's fast. So,
and it installs pretty much everywhere these days.
It installs everywhere, absolutely. This is one reason why I like Node over some other platforms. It's like it treats all platforms equally.
Cool. Any ideas, John?
Yeah, I'd agree. HTML and JavaScript and is the best. it's the best way to teach anyone that's new to programming because it's you actually like it. It's something everyone is familiar with, and you get really quick return on investment, and you don't have to mess with a lot. Everyone's got the tools. I taught my daughter some basic JavaScript like a year ago, and we used Codecademy. I'm a big fan of their, you know, simple learn to code thing. And it's just basic JavaScript. And it's nice because it's in browser. So it's basically like instructions on the left and a console looking thing on the right. And you type in and they have, you know, fix this line of code. Or, you know, we're showing how to do a loop to 10, make it a loop to 50. And inside the loop, make it do something else. You know, so and then it goes on to other things. They have jQuery courses and stuff. So that's nice. And then two two other things I like is JS Bin. I like that instead of just using the browser tools because they're a little bit too nerdy. And JS Bin lets you save work, and you know it's pretty slick. So you've got an HTML, CSS, JavaScript window. You can load in scripts. So that's a favorite of mine. And then I like Repl.it, REPL.IT. And that's nice because it's got like it's got JavaScript, Repl, but it also has like, you know, CoffeeScript and Python and Ruby and Forth if you're into Forth.
Interesting. All right, good. So last question of this round is I know everyone here has had a chance to play with Reardon.js and try out the fantastic Reardon Metal templating system. At least I think it's wonderful. John, what do you think?
I'm still having a little trouble getting it set up. It is interesting. The Reardon Metal, I really like the kind of, it's a very like smooth syntax for templating, and I like how it handles partials. I have to say that's kind of like you can compose these views together and it's all pretty slick.
Yeah, I mean, it started off feeling a little bit mysterious, maybe a little rebellious, but it's growing on me. What does Scott Kuhn think?
Well, at first I didn't like the data dash attributes that they were putting everywhere. It reminded me too much of Angular. But then I saw that they were completely optional, and you could just define your own convention-based binding, and so that it just kind of it put the magic in the magic cloud part of the diagram. And the fact that it was HTML5 and vanilla JS compatible was really nice. And it's a fast loading library too. It's got automatic AMD support, so there's no problem using it either server side with Node or client side. And yeah, I did like the metal templating system. It's a lot better than the handlebars, I think, simply because it introduces the logicless logical templates, which was it cut down on the number of templates that I needed when I was converting a handlebars project over from like 50 to 2, I think. And I thought that was pretty good. So yeah, I like it a lot.
Yeah, Kevin, is this something you might be able to work into your website?
You know, it could be. Like, you know, I've looked at, you know, Ember and Angular, and I've kind of stuck with Backbone, but this is really the first framework that I would consider as an alternative to Backbone. You know, I really like how it lets you take responsibility for the pieces you want to take responsibility for. And, a lot of frameworks sort of, you have to live in their world, and that isn't the case here. You know, it works really well with Vapor.js, which I'm also a fan of. So, yeah, I would definitely consider it, maybe for my next project anyway.
Yeah, okay. So Reardon.js and Vapor.js, that is an interesting combination. But I think that's all that we have time for this time. So in this episode, I should say. But thanks for listening, everybody, and tune in again next time.
Hey, this sounds awfully like we're planning something.
Oh, right.
Trouble.
No good can come from that.
Okay.
Sorry, I got my MC certification a couple weeks ago, and they said we had to have big design up front.
Oh, well, there we go. I prefer the Agile MC where...
Agile MC.
It's a little more like Bill O'Reilly where you just yell a lot.
Is Agile right. MC like freestyling? Is
that Shut up! We'll do it live.
We'll do it live.
I guess we're
Welcome.
Supposed to start.
Oh, yeah,
we'll
start.
should I shut up now?
All right, here we go.
Yeah.